and more by turning out to be from Southend and not from Detroit, as everybody thought. They then surprised the world even more by their complete failure to bring out an album within 4 months of the single on the grounds that they hadn't written it yet. And then, in a move of unparalleled marketing shrewdness and ingenuity, they also actually left A Whiter Shade of Pale off the album. They never did anything straightforwardly at all, as anyone who's ever tried to follow the chords of A Rum Tale will know. Now, they had one very, very particular effect on my life. It was a song they did, which I expect some of you here will know, called Grand Hotel. Whenever I'm writing, I tend to have music on in the background, and on this particular occasion, I had Grand Hotel on the record player. This song always used to interest me, because while Keith Reid's lyrics were all about this sort of beautiful hotel, the silver, the chandeliers, all those kinds of things, then suddenly, in the middle of the song, there was this huge orchestral climax that came out of nowhere and didn't seem to be about anything. I kept wondering, what was this huge thing happening in the background? And I eventually thought it sounds as if there ought to be some sort of floor show going on. Something huge and extraordinary, like, well, like the end of the universe. And so that was where the idea for the restaurant at the end of the universe came from. From Grand Hotel. Anyway, enough from me. We're in for a great night tonight. Them resolutions and having them fail, relatively speaking, 1,000 times earlier than usual. In fact, if I may digress for a moment, and if you don't want me to digress, then you may find that you are reading the wrong column, it turns out that there may be a very good reason why we fail to keep our New Year's resolutions, other than the obvious abject feebleness of will. It's this. We can't remember what they are. Simple. And if we actually wrote them down, then we probably can't remember where we put the piece of paper either. Oddly enough, the piece of paper has sometimes been known to turn up again exactly a year later when you're casting around for something on which to write the next year's abortive attempts to pull your life into some kind of shape. This is not, it turns out, a coincidence. Incidentally, am I alone in finding the expression, "it turns out," to be incredibly useful? It allows you to make swift, succinct, and authoritative connections between otherwise randomly unconnected statements without the trouble of explaining what your source or authority actually is. It's great. It's hugely better than its predecessors, I read somewhere that, or the Craven, they say that, because it suggests not only that whatever flimsy bit of urban mythology you are passing on is actually based on brand new, groundbreaking research, but that it is research in which you yourself were intimately involved. But again, with no actual authority anywhere in sight. Anyway, where was I? It seems that these memories are completely beyond the reach of your normal, sober mind. Which is why, after some ill-advised evening out, you will be the only person who is completely unaware of some barkingly stupid remark you made to someone whose feelings you care about deeply, or even just a bit. It is only weeks, months, or, in the case of New Year's Eve, exactly a year later that the occasion suddenly returns to your consciousness with a sickening whump, and you realize why people have been avoiding you or meeting your eyes with a glassy stare for so long. This can often result in you saying, "Jesus God!" to yourself in a loud voice and reaching for a stiff drink, which leads you up to the next point of inebriation, where, of course, fresh shocks await your pleasure. Effective methods of freshening up the brain on New Year's Day that don't involve actual cranial surgery. Hangover cures, please, therefore, to www.h2g2.com, and may the next 1,000 years be especially good ones for you and your descendants. The Independent on Sunday. My favorite tipples. I love whiskey in every way. I love the way it looks in the bottle, that rich golden color. I love the labels arranged on the shelf, the kilts and the claymores and the slightly out of focus sheep. I love the sense that it's a drink that, unlike, for instance, vodka from Warrington, is rich in the culture and history of the place where it is distilled. So I found them downstairs one morning, after having just had one glass of Chianti with my evening pizza. I therefore now drink Stolichnaya vodka martinis, if I go to New York, because they're very smart and sophisticated and New Yorkery, but most importantly, they render me incapable of doing anything stupid, or indeed anything at all, though I occasionally converse very knowledgeably about quantum chromodynamics and pig farming when under their influence. I like Bloody Marys, but only ever have them in airports. I have no explanation for this. It never occurs to me to have a Bloody Mary in the normal course of events. but put me in an airport lounge, and I make for the stolly and the tomato juice like a rat from a drainpipe, and arrive a few hours later at my destination, throbbing with jet lag. The book you promised to deliver 7 months ago, and faxes start arriving asking you if you could possibly write yet another short little introduction to a book that you clearly remember writing the end to in about 1981. It won't, promises the fax, take you 2 minutes. Damn right it won't take you 2 minutes. It actually takes about 13 hours, and you miss another dinner party, and your wife won't speak to you, and the book gets so late that you start missing entire camping holidays in the Pyrenees, and your wife won't talk to you, particularly since the camping holiday was your idea and not hers, and she was only going on it because you wanted to, and now she has to go and do it by herself, when you know perfectly well that she hates camping. So do I, incidentally. I'm making this bit up. And then more faxes come in demanding more introductions, this time for omnibus editions of books, each of which I have already written individual introductions to. After a while, I find I have written so many introductions that someone collects them all together and puts them in a book and asks me to write an introduction to it. So I miss another dinner party and also a scuba diving trip to the Azores, and I discover that the reason my wife isn't talking to me is that she is now, in fact, married to someone else. I am making this bit up as well, as far as I know. In the days when I used to be able to go to parties, in other words, in the days when I had only written a couple of books and the business of writing introductions to them had yet to become a full-time activity, it used to save a lot of time when you discovered that two of your friends didn't know each other, just to say to them, "This is Peter, this is Paula, why don't you introduce yourselves?" This usually worked fantastically well, and before you knew it, Peter and Paula would be a happy couple going off on joint skiing holidays in the French Alps with your wife and her second husband. So, dear reader, this is the anniversary reissue of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy radio scripts. Why don't you introduce yourselves? I have enjoyed this little chat. How should prospective writers go about becoming an author? First of all, realize that it's very hard, and that writing is a grueling and lonely business, and unless you are extremely lucky, badly paid as well. You had better really, really, really want to do it. Next, you have to write something. Unless you are committed to novel writing exclusively, I suggest that you start out writing for radio. It's still a relatively easy medium to get into because it pays so badly. But it is a great medium for writers because it relies so much on the imagination. You will learn a tremendous amount from it, and maybe get some useful exposure. Unfinished business of the century. Just a few more days to go. I think it's important not to leave a century, let alone a millennium, without cleaning up behind you, and there is clearly unfinished business to attend to. I suggest that the net community should try to identify this unfinished business and see if, between us, we can't get it squared away so that we can all enjoy the New Year celebrations with a sense of a century well done. But first is the only solid and reliable point we have in the entire sorry mess. And so perhaps we should be celebrating that, just a little bit. And instead of saying that we have got the end of the millennium or bi-millennium wrong, we should say that our ancestors got the beginning of it wrong, and that we've only just sorted the mess out before starting a new mess of our own. Anyway, what the hell does it matter anyway? It's just an excuse for a party. But first, to unfinished business. One particularly niggling piece of unfinished business, it occurred to me the other day in the middle of a singing session with my 5-year-old daughter, is the lyrics to Do Re Mi from The Sound of Music. It doesn't exactly rank as a global crisis, but nevertheless, it brings me up short any time. Well, it's obvious what kind of line it is. It's a placeholder. A placeholder is what a writer puts in when he can't think of the right line or idea just at the moment, but he'd better put in something and come back and fix it later. So I imagine that Oscar Hammerstein just bunged in a note to follow so and thought he'd have another look at it in the morning. Only when he came to have another look at it in the morning, he couldn't come up with anything better. Or the next morning. Come on, he must have thought. This is simple, isn't it? La, a something-something what? One can imagine rehearsals looming, recording dates. Maybe he'd be able to fix it on the day. Maybe one of the cast would come up with the answer. But no, no one manages to fix it. And gradually, a lame placeholder of a line became locked in place. Dream alternative careers. Zoologist? Rock musician? System software designer? Dream holiday. Intense scuba diving in Australia, out beyond the Great Barrier Reef to the wonderful clarity of the Coral Sea. Codhole, shark diving, wreck diving. Then to Western Australia to dive with enormous whale sharks, and finally to Shark Bay to dive with dolphins. Then I'd stop off for dinner in Hong Kong on the way home. Dream home. Something large and rambling on a beach somewhere, probably far north Queensland, with lots of wildlife around and high-bandwidth computer connections to the rest of the world. Also a boat and a pickup truck. Dream cuisine. If I was told I had to choose the cuisine of one country and eat only that for the rest of my life, I'd choose Japanese. Dream day out. I've already had this, in fact. It was 1968. A friend of mine and I took the day off school, went up to London and saw 2001 in Cinerama in the afternoon, and Simon and Garfunkel live at the Albert Hall in the evening. Where did you get the inspiration for your books? I tell myself I can't have another cup of coffee until I've thought of an idea. Music over and over again. Not while I'm doing the actual writing, of course, you need things to be pretty quiet for that, but while I'm fetching another cup of coffee, or making toast, or polishing my spectacles, or trying to find more toner for the printer, or changing my guitar strings, or clearing away the coffee cups and toast crumbs from my desk, or retiring to the bathroom to sit and think for half an hour. In other words, most of the day. The result is that a lot of my ideas come from songs. Well, one or two at least. To be absolutely accurate, there is just one idea that came from a song, but I keep the habit up just in case it works again, which it won't, but never mind. The idea for the restaurant at the end of the universe started with a track called Grand Hotel by Procol Harum. Most of the song describes the scene in an opulent restaurant. Silver, candlelight, chandeliers, etc. Then towards the end of the song there is a long orchestral section which builds to a huge climax for no readily apparent reason. I wondered what this climax was meant to signify. I had a bit of toast and thought about it. Well, I thought, it's probably just the universe coming to an end. So now you know how it's done. Simple, isn't it? Is on end, blissed out on sun, cheap wine and art. Recent visits have overlaid those earlier memories with traffic jams and smog. Now I think I'd say that my favourite city is just a small town, Santa Fe in New Mexico. I love the high desert air, the margaritas and the guacamole, the silver belt buckles, and the sense that people sitting at the next table to you in the cafe are probably Nobel laureates. When was the last time you hitchhiked? About 10 years ago, on the island of Rodriguez, in the Indian Ocean. Hitchhiking them, and I can't help but wonder why. I'm convinced that if we go back far enough in the history of the human species, we will find some beaver genes creeping in there somewhere. It's the only explanation which makes sense. Have you ever been there? I haven't been to the Yangtze since construction started. I never want to see the thing. And the most interesting natural structure. A giant 2,000-mile-long fish in orbit around Jupiter, according to a reliable report in the Weekly World News. The photograph was very convincing, and I'm only surprised that more reputable journals like New Scientist or even Just the Sun haven't followed up with more details. We should be told. If you were to name a place that looks like it's just been dropped from outer space, where would you think of? Fiordland in South Island, New Zealand. An impossible jumble of mountains, waterfalls, lakes and ice. The most extraordinary place I think I've ever seen. If you could go anywhere in the universe right now, where would you go? How would you get there? And who and what would you take with you? Locally, I think Europa, one of the 16 moons of Jupiter. It's one of the most mysterious bodies in the solar system. Much beloved of science fiction writers because it's one of the few places that could possibly sustain life of some kind. And there are certain oddities in its structure which have led to wild speculations about it being artificial. Plus, on nights when the orbital alignments are right, you must get a great view of the fish. September the 22nd, 1999. With a knife, I think they would draw the line. In between the squalls of rain and trumpets, I fell into conversation with an engaging fellow who turned out to be my sister's next-door neighbour up there in Warwickshire, which was where the sodden field was. His name was Martin Pemberton, and he was an inventor and designer. Among the things he had invented or designed, he told me, were various crucial bits of tube trains, a wonderful new form of thinking toaster, and also a sub-bug. What, I asked politely, was a sub-bug? A sub-bug, he explained, was a jet-propelled underwater buggy sort of thing, a bit like the front half of a dolphin. You hold on to the rear, and it pulls you through the sea at depths of up to 30 feet. Remember that bit in the movie of Thunderball? A bit like those things. Great for exploring coral reefs. I'm not sure if that's exactly what he said. He may have said, azure sea, or limpid depths. Probably not, but that was the picture in my brain as I sat in the blustery rain watching an escaped umbrella totter past the bandstand. I had to try one. I said so to Martin. I may even have wrestled him to the ground and knelt on his windpipe. Everything was a bit of a blur, to be honest, but anyway, he said he would be delighted to let me try one. The question was where. I could try it anywhere, even just in the local swimming pool. No. The trick was to get to try it in Australia, on the Great Barrier Reef. I needed an angle wonderful in the book that she was reading. Did I know, she asked, that Brisbane was originally founded as a penal colony for convicts who committed new offences after they had arrived in Australia? Possible worlds that you have come to, for you to concern yourself about in any way at all. Really? Really? We don't even despise you. Really? No worries at all. If only it were true. I had my sub-bug to worry about, of course. This huge great thing that I had lugged 10 times further than Moses had dragged the children of Israel just in order to see how it compared with a manta ray as a means of getting about underwater. It had been quietly removed from the boat in its huge silver-coloured box and discreetly stored at the dive centre where nobody could see it or guess at its purpose. The phone rang in our room. The room was extremely pleasant, incidentally. I'm sure you're keen to hear what the room was like, since we were staying in it at your expense. It was not enormous, but it was very comfortable and sunny and tastefully decorated in Californian pastels. Our favourite item was the balcony, which overlooked the sea because it had an awning which you lowered by pressing an electric switch. The switch had 2 settings. You could either turn it to auto, in which case the awning lowered itself whenever the sun came out, or you could set it to manuel, in which case, we assumed, a small, incompetent Spanish waiter came and did it for you. We thought, inside the bug is a cylinder of compressed air, a normal scuba cylinder, and this provides power to spin the 2 propellers which push the bug forward, and also supplies air down a flexible tube to a free-floating regulator. A regulator is the thing you stick in your mouth which gives you your air when you're diving. The point of this arrangement is that you only need your mask and flippers. You don't need to carry a scuba tank on your own back, because you're getting your air direct from the sub-bug. The bug is designed in such a way that you can set a maximum depth beyond which it will not go. The very maximum, anyway, is 30 feet. Ian had received a flurry of faxes from Martin Pemberton about setting up the machine and was pretty confident about it. No worries at all, he said, and asked me what I planned. But the big points that the sub-bug wins are for the fact that you can actually get on it. I think it has to get a lot of credit for that if you're thinking of it as transport. But then let's turn the whole thing around again. The reason you can't actually ride a manta ray is a sound ecological one, and on just about every ecological criterion, the manta ray wins hands down. In fact, any form of transport that you can't actually use would be a major ecological benefit, don't you think? Ian nodded understandingly. Can I get on and read my book now, please? Said Jane. Its shape more clearly. It was very roughly diamond-shaped. Its tail is not long, like a stingray's. The most extraordinary thing is its head. Where you would expect its head to be, it's almost as if something has taken a bite out of it instead. From the 2 forward points, the outer edges of the bite, if you see what I mean, depend 2 horns, folded downwards. And on each of these horns is a single large black eye. As it moved, shimmering and undulating its giant wings, folding itself through the water, I felt that I was looking at the single most beautiful and unearthly thing I had ever seen in my life. Some people have described them as looking like living stealth bombers, but it is an evil image to apply to a creature so majestic, fluid, and benign. I followed it as it swam around the outside of the reef. I couldn't follow fast or well, but it was making such wide, sweeping turns that I only had to move relatively short distances round the reef to keep it in sight. 2, even 3 times it circled round the reef, and then at last it disappeared, and I thought I had lost it for good. I stopped and looked around. No, it had definitely gone. I was saddened but exhilarated with wonder at what I had seen. Then I became aware of a shadow moving on the sea floor at the periphery of my vision. I looked up, unprepared for what I then saw. The manta ray soared over the top of the reef above me, only this time it had 2 more in its wake behind it. Together the 3 vast creatures, moving in perfect undulating harmony of line, as if following invisible roller coaster rails, sped off and away until they were lost at last in the darkening distance of the water. I was very quiet that evening as we packed the sub-bug back in its big silver box. I thanked Ian for finding the manta rays. I said I understood about not riding them. Ah, no worries, mate, he said. No worries at all. written in 1992. Who are your favorite authors? Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, Kurt Vonnegut, P.G. Wodehouse, Ruth Rendell. Close to a master actually at work. A bit like seeing paint pots and scaffolding being carried in and out of the Sistine Chapel. Master? Great genius? Oh, yes. One of the most blissful jokes saying it's something to do with the fact that Shakespeare was writing the 16th century? What difference does that make? Chaucer had no difficulty being funny as hell way back in the 14th century when the spelling was even worse. Maybe it's because our greatest writing genius was incapable of being funny that we have decided that being funny doesn't count. Which is tough on Wodehouse, as if he could have cared less, because his entire genius was for being funny, and being funny in such a sublime way as to put mere poetry in the shade. The precision with which he plays upon every aspect of a word's character simultaneously, its meaning, timbre, rhythm, the range of its idiomatic connections and flavours, would make Keats whistle. Keats would have been proud to have written, "The smile vanished from his face like breath off a razor blade," or of Honoria Glossop's laugh, that it sounded like cavalry on a tin bridge. Speaking of which, Shakespeare, when he wrote, "A man may smile and smile and be a villain," might have been at least as impressed by, "Many a man may look respectable and yet be able to hide at will behind a spiral staircase." Write similes if you insist. You don't mess with the master. Of course, Wodehouse never burdened himself with the task of justifying the ways of God to man, but only of making man, for a few hours at a time, inextinguishably happy. Wodehouse better than Milton? Well, of course, it's an absurd comparison, but I know which one I'd keep in the balloon, and not just for his company, but for his art. We would act perfectly legal. When the kettle has boiled, pour a little of it into a teapot, swirl it around, and tip it out again. Put a couple, or three, depending on the size of the pot, of tea bags, into the pot. If I was really trying to lead you into the path of righteousness, I would tell you to use free leaves rather than bags, but let's just take this in easy stages. Bring the kettle back to the boil, and then pour the boiling water as quickly as you can into the pot. Let it stand for 2 or 3 minutes, and then pour it into a cup. Some people will tell you that you shouldn't have milk with Earl Grey tea, just a slice of lemon. Screw them. I like it with milk. If you think you will like it with milk, then it's probably best to put some milk into the bottom of the cup before you pour it.
This ends Disc 2.